So I'm happy to continue the discussion that we began last time on developing samadhi, and that we also explored in the meditation today. And I remember at the end of last time, I invited people, if they wish, to practice it during the week. And how many have given some emphasis to samadhi in the last week? Good. Very, very good. So I want to give plenty of time after I finish a talk for us to really speak together about our practice of cultivating samadhi, what's come up, what's challenging, what are the insights. And again, for anyone who wasn't here last time, I was inspired in part. Samadhi was one of the two main themes I talked about last time, probably had most of the actual time. But I was inspired because I came from a month of practicing cultivating samadhi during the month of March at Spirit Rock. And actually, since my retreat, I've stayed with probably about 2.5 to 3 hours a day of formal practice, developing samadhi. It's still very much alive. And one of the beautiful aspects of the deeper practices that I mentioned last time, called the jhanas, are that when they're developed well, they are accessible in daily life. These are the deeper absorption states pointed out by the Buddha, and they're very wonderful, beautiful states. I mentioned that the first state is sometimes called the state of rapture or piti. The second emphasizes happiness. The third, contentment and peacefulness. The fourth is stillness and equanimity. And then the fifth through the eighth are so-called formless states, infinite space, infinite consciousness, and so forth. So, particularly thinking of the first four states, they are just wonderful states to be in. And again, after we practice a fair amount, they're accessible. Just really, I don't know, I was going to come up with terms, and they're kind of, to use a Buddhist technical term, they're scrumptious. Scrumptious states. Wonderful. So that's inspired me to continue. And also, maybe to say something that I mentioned last time, one of the beautiful things about developing samadhi is that as we practice more, the baseline level for samadhi increases. The neuroscientists have shown basically that samadhi is something that the brain learns. The brain learns to be more deeply concentrated, in other words. What that means, if you stay with it, your base level for stability of mind will be greater in 2 years than it is now. And I've certainly seen that over a lot of years. That is pretty wonderful. So I want to speak about a few further aspects of cultivating samadhi, a little bit more about the general nature of samadhi and its importance in our practice. Very briefly about the different ways to practice, which I mentioned some in the instructions, and particularly focus on some of the challenges of cultivating samadhi. And maybe a little bit about the relation of cultivating samadhi to insight practice. So, as I've mentioned, the term samadhi in its etymology could be translated as placing together. I like to use the original word samadhi because the English word concentration has connotations of over-efforting, trying really hard, bearing down. And the essence of samadhi is a combination of persistence with relaxation. It's a combination of what I've called in the guided practice, active effort with more relaxed, receptive effort. And we each in our practice have to find how that balance works for ourselves. And so I like that, really coming back to the etymology, placing together. We could also talk about it as unifying mind and heart. One author, some of you know, a friend who teaches retreats on samadhi, Richard Shankman, and wrote a very good book simply called Samadhi, speaks about samadhi as unifying the mind in steady, undistracted awareness. And there are a lot of different ways to practice. There are a lot of different ways to practice the jhana, the jhanas. One of the methods which I also practice, we can use the slide now, Bill, was a Tibetan practice actually coming from Mahayana called the elephant path. And this is an image of the elephant path. It's a beautiful system, which is about nine stages of developing samadhi. And the word that was used in Tibetan to translate samadhi is a word meaning staying, which I think is a very nice metaphor and really image of what samadhi is. It's staying with what the mind intends it to stay with. And so these are the nine stages of staying. And the mind is likened to being like a wild elephant. The mind is very smart and strong, but it easily kind of goes crazy, gets a little bit freaked out, and stampedes. And so the Tibetans found that the training of elephant was a good metaphor. Eventually, and you can see how the elephant at first is kind of on its own, chasing a monkey. As the practice develops, it becomes a friend, you can see, to the monkey. It actually starts changing color and becomes an ally of the monk. One interesting thing to know is that you can see, particularly at the places where the path goes around a bend, you can see flames there. Those flames are actually where one practices intensifying what we did in the last third of the meditation, putting special effort out to connect with the object. So that method of intensifying comes from this particular system. We can let go of the slide now. But I think the sense of this very simple metaphor of simply staying with the object is really something that we can remember. I think that samadhi is a very natural quality of our being. There are a lot of ways that we find ourselves very naturally in very, you could say, very deep concentration. When we're, you know, I remember one of my first major discovery. Well, actually, I remember going when I was a child, going to the ocean in Maryland and being so entranced by the sun that I would go into this almost like reverie where my mind was completely still. And I remembered that as I later came into practicing. Another memory I had was a time in college when I didn't do this very often, but I stayed up all night to write an essay, which I didn't do too much, but this time I was totally focused for hours and hours and hours, maybe 4 or 5 hours. And I came into the dawn and my mind was completely still. And I saw the world like I had never seen it before. And I was, maybe 20 or 21. And that stayed with me. And I remembered that when I started developing a samadhi practice. The poet and Buddhist practitioner Gary Snyder says he thinks that actually the cultivation of samadhi may have come actually from the act of hunting, where one needed to be very, very still and totally focused. It's interesting. This is from the Buddha. There comes a time when one's mind and heart become inwardly steadied, composed, unified, and concentrated. That concentration is then calm and refined, attained to full tranquility and mental and emotional unification. We no longer need to suppress the hindrances or what gets in the way. I think we know that for the Buddha, developing samadhi was one of the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So it was seen as very central. And I may have mentioned last time that actually some of the techniques for developing samadhi, like the methods of the jhanas, actually come from what the Buddha learned from the yogic traditions and the teachers who were his first teachers before he developed his own system. So the emphasis on samadhi is very deep in what we would, in the traditions of what we would call India. Some of you maybe know the writings of Patanjali, the Yoga Sutra, and that's a place where samadhi is also emphasized, and gives pretty detailed instructions on that. And samadhi is very central. It appears on several of the lists, the five spiritual faculties, in addition to the Eightfold Path, the seven factors of awakening, the five powers, and so forth. I mentioned that there are many ways we can do some cultivate samadhi with the breath or with the heart practices, chanting, visualization, and again, even looking at an object. Again, that's used in multiple traditions. Actually, in Western practice, samadhi is not always emphasized so much, and it's only fairly recently that there were longer retreats offered to develop samadhi. So for some of us, really cultivating it with depth can be a missing piece. So it's really something that is valuable to develop. Of course, it's tremendously valuable as it gets deeper. We become able to cut through our mental and emotional stuff much more easily, much more quickly, when that's wise to do. If I need to attend to something and I'm just having chatter occur, that's not important for me. With samadhi, I can really cut through it. Eventually, we link samadhi with insight practice, and the samadhi, this quiet of the mind, is necessary for deeper insight into, particularly the Buddha emphasized insight into impermanence, the nature of dukkha or reactivity, how the mind goes into grabbing at things or pushing away things, and into the very nature of the self. That samadhi is really, really crucial. It also gives us a taste when the samadhi is strong of these beautiful qualities of our own inwardness. of the of the potentials of our own being to go to beautiful states, that our own being has these awesome potentials that we can access, and many of you have accessed many of these beautiful states. And samadhi can really let us know some of these deeper potentials of the mind and heart and so forth. And the Buddha said that samadhi is totally necessary for awakening and liberation from the Buddha. Without the peace of samadhi, without attaining to calm, without winning one-pointedness, that one could enter and abide in emancipation, in inside emancipation, that is not possible without samadhi. And so again, many ways of cultivating samadhi. I mentioned, with the breath, with focus on particular area of the body, body sensations, sound, metta, compassion, joy, equanimity, looking at things. So, what are some of the challenges of our practice? I'm going to mention these and we can come back to some of what we've experienced in our own practice. Some of these are obvious and some less obvious, and I want to name them first and then come back and give a little more detail with each of them. One challenge, of course, is our minds becoming distracted, becoming overly active. A second challenge of developing samadhi is that when we do it at some length, we actually can activate some of our own inner unconscious material that's beneath the surface. And that can surface. We see this a lot in the metta retreat. And this can happen in concentration practice, that things come up like unconscious stuff, our old wounds. And so we talk about the second challenge as being the challenges of what we sometimes call a purification process that occurs as we cultivate samadhi. A third challenge is getting overly attached to deeper states of samadhi, both when we have them and when we don't have them. How many people would like to have the challenge of being attached to deeper states of samadhi? Okay. That's, okay, I'm willing to face that challenge. Give me deeper states of samadhi. We might say that. And then a fourth challenge related to what I just said that is there for most of us, certainly has been there for me a lot, is over-efforting and striving, trying to get somewhere. That can be especially the case when we do retreats. Okay, so first challenge, I'll try to be brief with these, maybe just a few minutes each, and give plenty of time for our talking together. A lot of the first challenge of an overactive mind, of course, comes from our cultural conditioning, right? That we know that there's just so much thought, so much stimulation in the culture. The Thai Buddhist teacher, Buddha Dasa, was once asked, "What do you think of Western civilization?" He said, "Lost in thought." And I know when I was first practicing, I was a student and I thought all the time and I thought I was supposed to be thinking all the time. And I just noticed when I first started meditating, I'm thinking all the time, my gosh. And so we're all really conditioned in many ways to have that thinking occur a lot. And when we practice samadhi, we really go through a few stages with working with the busyness of the mind. Initially, of course, we see like the main thoughts. We get our top five or our top 10 list. And when we get that, we can notice them more quickly, notice them sooner. As we develop more samadhi, we can start to have the mind at times be more quiet. I know when I did my first retreat, I said, "My gosh, this is amazing, miraculous." It was so really heartwarming to know. And for me, like for many of you, as I opened up to a quiet mind, it also activated the subtle energy of the body, which I knew nothing about, which was developing a kind of bliss in the body, which is actually one of the factors that goes along with deepening samadhi, right? And so as we deepen, we can start to notice thoughts earlier on. Eventually, when the mind gets very quiet, we can notice how the mind works, that there's actually, when the mind gets quiet, we can notice, oh, there's a seed almost of a thought. When the mind gets very quiet, we can just hear a little burp in the mind. And that burp, I know, oh, that's going to be financial issue number two. But it's just a burp and it doesn't go anywhere. When we're not so aware, that burp becomes elaborated and turns into 3 minutes thinking about financial issue number two. And as the mind gets more quiet, we can notice that process. We can notice how that little seed gets turned into a thought or two, which gets turned into multiple thoughts, which gets turned into daydreaming. And with samadhi practice, we reverse the process. And we come back increasingly to a place where thoughts don't last very long. The practice of intensifying that I gave during the guided meditation is very interesting because as we deepen, we also start to see, as I mentioned, that we have gross thoughts and we also have subtle thoughts. And with cultivating samadhi, we get to a level where the gross thoughts have gone away, but the subtle thoughts are still there. That's when we use the technique of intensifying. Again, maybe once, maybe two or three times in a half hour sitting, really putting out 2 or 3 minutes of effort. That can be really, really helpful. And maybe one further thing to say that can be really, really helpful with the overly active mind. I find that body practices are really, really crucial. And we've had times when we've experimented with this in retreats where we've taught Qigong, where Tisha Bell taught Qigong at retreats. And we did sittings right afterwards. And almost everyone said after the Qigong, the mind was more quiet. And I've actually sometimes invited people I work with when their minds are just overly, overly active to really have a regular body practice like Qigong or could be yoga. Qigong is very helpful because it works with the breath and it really quiets the mind. Okay. A second challenge, I forgot to mention this earlier. Second challenge I wanted to mention, which I'll talk about briefly, this happens in retreats sometimes more than at home, is sleepiness and low energy. That's another challenge and very, very normal challenge. And this is again where maybe a body practice can be helpful. Sometimes we get into a state which we call a sinking mind, in which we have more concentration and less energy, and the mind goes into a kind of a pleasant dreamlike state where we think, oh, I've kind of arrived, but it's actually not very concentrated. How many people have had that happen at some point? Yeah. We call it the sinking mind And there we need more energy. That would mean do a vigorous walk for 10 minutes before you sit. That can be really, really helpful. When we have the sinking mind, we want to do something that brings up the energy of the body. And then I won't say too much about what I've called the purification process. All sorts of things can come up. We have maybe unresolved issues come up when we're doing this. This is probably a little bit more on retreats that we can have this purification process occur. It can come up in daily life when we get really quiet. It's almost like we make room for some of our stuff to surface. So if that's happening, know that it's normal and actually a sign, we might say a progress, actually helpful. It can be, something from our past that's maybe a wound that is there from the past or an unresolved issue, something related to relationships or significant issues in our lives. It could be becoming, noticing ourselves being more judgmental and so forth. And just to know that this is part of the process, we can have ways to work with what comes up with mindfulness. The general guideline is, as I mentioned in the guided practice, when something comes up, like as part of the purification process, and it lasts for at least a minute or two or longer and has energy, that's when we switch to mindfulness practice. We actually, when something comes up that might be some of our more unconscious material, we actually can stay with it with mindfulness, even if it's staying the rest of the meditation. That happens a lot, for example, on the metta retreat, which is really developing samadhi. All sorts of things come up for people. People deal with parental issues and stay with grief or loss or anger for a lot of time. And that's normal. That would be called part of the purification process, not a problem. Okay. The fourth challenge, attachment to concentrated states. This can happen both after we have experienced deeper states, and we can want to have them, want them to stay, try to make them happen, and so forth. And it also happens a lot when we do more practice, especially on retreats. I experienced this a lot, that I wanted to get to a certain level to be a good meditator. Has anyone experienced something like that? Yeah. And it's almost like I had to go through a certain amount of suffering to learn about that. And, I had a 5-week retreat where I was developing samadhi with metta. I didn't think I was getting deep enough. The metta was a beautiful reward, but I thought I wasn't going deeply enough. And I suffered and I learned from that. The next time I did a long retreat developing samadhi, I knew that I didn't want to worry about how much progress I made. And I also heard I was doing a retreat developing the jhanas in the Burmese tradition. And I had heard that two of my senior colleagues, I won't name their names, but had not got very far with this approach. And they were much more senior than me at the, then and now. And I said, okay, the pressure's off. And I cultivated samadhi. And I actually, I don't know, I got further than they did. And I had actually had openings and breakthroughs, all because it didn't matter to me, really, sincerely, how deeply I went. Isn't that interesting? Very, and we have to, it's very helpful to remember that. And so again, we want to watch for the attachment. We want to watch for the wanting to get somewhere, and just keep coming back and noticing and try to let go. And then know that that is almost like a natural tendency. So let me finish up with that, and we can open things up to discussion. Let me see how I want to finish. Just a little bit about developing samadhi and insight practice. The Buddha taught samadhi in order to have liberating insight. And in particular, and I teach retreats that do this sometimes, we develop samadhi and then we bring it to insight practice. Because samadhi in itself doesn't lead to awakening or freedom, but it's a very, very helpful tool. And the Buddha saw, as in the quotation I gave, that it's a necessary tool for having insight. That we only really have deep insight when we develop deep samadhi. And so the Buddha really taught samadhi for that purpose. And we can really see, one way to practice is to develop samadhi up to a certain point and then bring the practice, transfer it to insight practice. This is from Achen Chah, the great teacher from the Thai forest tradition. Meditation is like a single stick of wood. Insight meditation or vipassana is one end of the stick, and developing samadhi is the other. If we pick it up, if we pick up this stick, does only one end come up or do both? Insight has to develop out of peace and tranquility. The entire process happens naturally on its own accord. Let me finish with that and open things up to our discussion. Let me invite everyone just to sit quietly for a minute. See what may have resonated with you, anything you want to ask about, and also any thing you want to share about your own practice. Share about your practice or ask a question about your practice. So let's take about a minute of quiet first, and then we'll open things up. So thanks. We can open things up now, and good to see everyone on Zoom. I love being in person also last week, or I guess it was hybrid, but let me see if anyone has a question. Patty, please, for a sharing.
Thank you, Donald. Something that gets in my way, I think, comes in the category of doubt,
Yeah.
because I doubt that this is, it feels selfish almost to be cultivating samadhi, and I prefer metta because that feels more productive. It feels like I'm doing something. It feels like I'm sharing love and spreading love. Whereas with samadhi, I feel like it's all inward, and metta feels more outward. So I comfort myself with the thought that metta is a path to samadhi, but I don't want to concentrate on the samadhi so much as the metta because it feels selfish.
I think it's important what you just brought out at the end, that practicing metta naturally develops samadhi. Right?
Right, I see that it works for me, but I don't want to concentrate on the fact that that's why I'm doing metta because I feel that's not pure almost.
Yeah, I think I would invite you to maybe go back to the last part of the talk where it says that cultivating samadhi is in large part a means to an end to develop insight, to quiet the mind so we can see clearly and is crucial for that. That can be developed with metta, though. And so, again, samadhi is one of the eight factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So I think it's, and also it, you know, it gives us these beautiful states that we can be in that I was bringing up at the end, the jhanas. So I think, Patty, would it, to see samadhi, I think if you really fully practice metta, you know, maybe experiment for a week or two, see if this resonates with you, to do it in your usual way half the time, and then practice metta with the aim of cultivating samadhi. And actually, in my experience, it doesn't particularly change how I practice. Maybe that's something to look at. It really doesn't change how I practice, you know, except that if I work with the phrases, I keep coming back. I don't, you know, and so I imagine that when you practice metta, you're already cultivating samadhi and you don't even need to think about it more.
Well, that would be great because I think that's true. I think I am cultivating samadhi, but I don't want to think of it as a practice so that I'm cultivating samadhi. I love that it's a side effect of the metta.
Yeah. Well, I think let me invite you to be open to the fact that samadhi is a beautiful, crucial quality for awakening.
Thank you.
Yeah, but no pressure. Okay. Thanks, Espati. Interesting question. Yeah. And yeah, just can stay with the metta. Yeah. Bill, please.
I love metta practice and find it very rewarding, not only for its own sake, but also that it has turned out for me to be a great path to samatha.
Yeah.
But at first, I find it very easy. I found it easy to understand samatha as you follow the breath. When you lose the breath, you go back to the breath, et cetera. Yeah. When I first heard of metta practice being taught as a jhana practice, I laughed. I thought that was hilarious. I did not believe it because metta, the way I understood it, got me so mental. You know, the whole thing of visualizing somebody and saying the phrases, I would start running home movies in my head.
Yeah.
And the phrases just got me just into thinking spirals.
Yeah.
I had to experiment, and it wasn't until I went on a metta retreat and I could play around with different things that I found something that actually worked for me. So I think that can be a disadvantage for people is if you have a metta, if you're doing metta, different forms of metta work differently for different people. And if you haven't found one that works for you, you might get very stuck on it or very much into mental processes rather than feeling that sort of radiant energy that can be so engaging and so immersive.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Bill. Important questions. A few things occurred to me. The main way that we teach metta in the West is through the repetition of phrases, which comes from the Visuddhimagga, not from the Buddha.
Right.
Right. And the repetition of phrases, main way we teach, I've been connected with the January Metta Retreat for almost 25 years. And that's what we teach, the repetition of phrases. I particularly emphasize in my teaching the way that it's really helpful to stay connected to the body and the heart, even as we're repeating phrases. So I actually, some of you know this if you've done the January retreat. I give techniques that help us stay more embodied and more in the emotions, you know, particularly with some techniques. And the other piece is, and I think you were really suggesting this, is that as the metta deepens, actually the phrases drop away. The phrases drop away, and there tends to be more a radiating energy in the heart area. And that becomes a very, very easy focus for samadhi. And that's how it opens up to the deeper states like the jhanas. It's when the metta gets deep enough that the phrases aren't there, but the loving energy is all that's there.
Enormous piti and sukha just radiates.
Yeah, me. Just that radiating energy in the heart. And then, you know, and then the words aren't there. Don't even need to be there. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for bringing that out. Anyone want to share what you might have experienced? Zoe, please.
Okay, so this is not so much a sharing as a question. In the beginning, you talked about the three parts of samadhi with the breath, and you mentioned the pause.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Because if the pause is only lasting a few seconds, I'm not really clear on what's happening or what's supposed to be happening in the pause.
Yeah, it's basically it's an optional technique, right? And I'm not aware that the Buddha taught it.
No.
So it's an optional technique that many people have found really helpful for deepening samadhi, because it's in the pause between the out-breath and the in-breath. There's also a short pause between the in-breath and the out-breath, and it's different for different people, but the one after the out-breath is typically longer. It's also the time when many people get distracted, right? And so, and it may, might just last half a second or a second, so it's pretty brief. And so what one does is, as soon as one notices the end of the out-breath, in right at that end, you switch. And this can take a little while to feel comfortable. It can feel a little bit artificial at first, but then when you stay with it, you can get used to it. As soon as the out-breath ends, right at that moment, pretty precisely, you switch to some area of focus. It could be the hands touching. I do it with my whole body. I just go right to the whole body, and then I wait for the in-breath to come naturally. And as soon as it comes, I switch my attention there. So it's pretty brief, but when and it can take a little while for it to be natural. But it for a lot of people I've worked with, it really, really is helpful for becoming more concentrated. Really, really can make a difference for a lot of people. Yeah.
Thank you.
Does that get at it, Zoe?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Barbara, please.
Yeah, I found that technique helpful, and I wanted a point to clarify or for you to clarify. When you go to the body part or the other place after during the pause, is it always the same place or do you switch?
Always the same place.
Always the same place.
Okay. Yeah, you don't want to be thinking about it at all.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you.
It just becomes something that becomes mm-hmm. how you work. When you've done it 1,000 times, it just is what happens.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, and thanks for letting us know you've worked with it. Maybe time for one more, then we should go to our metta. Including people that want to just share what worked for you, what a challenge, anything like that.
I can say something, Donald.
Sure.
And actually, it's a little bit of support that I'm needing, because I do the Gil Samadhi practice in the mornings, and it was going pretty well, and I've been going into some really deep states, and it's actually been pretty profound for me. But then the last couple of weeks, I started checking my email before I started, you know, work email. And now I find that I'm very distracted during his sits, and that I'm not getting as deeply in. So I guess the answer is, of course, don't check my email before I get on, but you know how that is. But anyway, but it has been a really profound practice for me these past, like, about 2 months, I guess we've been doing it. But I will say also that I've been, I think I've told this story really quickly, I'll tell it again, before, that I was having a lot of trouble at work a long time ago. And I went to Rick Hansen and I said, I'm having a lot of trouble at work with my boss. And he said, you need to start doing metta. And I said, there's no way I'm going to do metta. That's for wimps. That's for people that need to tell themselves that they need the fluff, and I don't need the fluff. And he said, you need to do metta even more now. And I started doing metta, and it was, again, really life-changing. Like, it just really changed my life. But my boss stopped bugging me, things started going well, and I realized how much I hadn't really treated myself very well. That I really did need metta. Rick was so right. So anyway, all the concentration practice, I love it. If I could do 2 months samadhi and go away and do that, I would do it in a heartbeat. Sounds amazing. I'm very jealous.
Yeah, well, Isabel, why don't, once you have that as a longer term intention, that sounds like you're really called in that way. And just start with a week or 10 days. Don't have to do a month if that's too hard with your schedule. And yeah, I remember our discussion from last week about actually several from the group had been doing the morning practices with Gil. It sounds wonderful. And I think you answered your own question about how to work with the email. I think the Buddha was very, very consistent in counseling not reading email before practicing.
Well, I'll definitely take that to heart then. I believe that with every fiber in me.
Right, and I real but it really points to a larger point that what we do right before we do formal practice actually matters. And I personally, especially my morning practice, I always do about 15 minutes of Qigong right before sitting, and it makes a huge difference, I think, as I was mentioning earlier. So really can consider that. Yeah.
Yeah, protect my practice from work and
Protect your practice and not to do something right before, or even, protect the time right before it very quickly.
thank you for that, and thank you for the talk, Donald.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Thanks for your practice.